All right, let's get started here. Ben, welcome. And as you know, and now that we can see Mr. Boulette's video, this oral argument is being conducted via Zoom. There will be an audio recording of this argument available on our website for others who may want to listen to it. Each side, as you also know, no doubt, has 15 minutes to argue, and appellant has 5 minutes for rebuttal. If anybody has any additional technical issues, just let us know. If you can't hear us, we can't hear you, whatever, and we'll fix it and move on. So, Marshall, do you want to call the case?
Yes, calling case A21009, John Alex Walker, petitioner appellant versus Laura Margaret Walker, respondent.
All right. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Boulette, on behalf of appellant John Walker. May it please the court, the district court here in this marriage dissolution matter left Ms. Walker with far more than she needs, while leaving Mr. Walker with far less. And we've identified that defect as primarily in three areas: in the district court's award of spousal maintenance, in the district court's award of above guideline child support, and the district court's award of attorney's fees. I'm going to begin first with the maintenance and child support awards because those errors are intertwined. At the heart of the district court's errors, Your Honor, are really two issues: understanding Mr. Walker's ability to pay, his financial wherewithal on the one hand, as well as Ms. Walker's need and the children's need on the other. Starting with Mr. Walker's ability to pay, this court has long has old precedent that in determining an obligor's ability to pay, those findings have to be based on the record, and they have to get us to a finding of net or after-tax income. Mr. Walker can't pay Ms. Walker with money he has to pay to the federal or state government for his taxes. So since this court's decision in Kostelnik in the 1980s, there have been more than a dozen cases that have reversed for the failure to make an appropriate finding of net income when determining an obligor's spousal maintenance obligation. That's precisely what happened here. The district court looked to Mr. Walker's income, it took his gross income, divided by 12, and said, based on that number, Mr. Walker can pay spousal maintenance in the amounts ordered. What it failed to do are two things. First, critically, just got the gross income number wrong. And that's an error that respondent concedes that was brought to the district court's attention post-trial, and the district court simply refused to fix. As troublesome, though, the court didn't do the math to reach a net income figure, despite the fact that ample evidence was available to it. Now, as we mentioned, the Kostelnik case requires the court to base an award of maintenance on net income.
So, counsel, I'd like to ask you about the Kostelnik case. I don't think anybody here, I didn't see it in respondent's brief, disagrees with the rule of law that you take out of Kostelnik, that it's important for a district court to look at net income in determining ability to pay. But Kostelnik was definitely factually a different case in that we were looking at the district court. Rather, this court remanded because there hadn't been that net analysis, and it was a little more complicated in that case because we were looking at removal of business expenses to determine the obligor's ability to pay, which, you know, as pointed out in respondent's brief here, you acknowledge in your brief that finding Mr. Walker's net income in this case isn't very difficult. There was a lot of evidence presented on it by the experts. You've included it in some helpful charts in your brief. And so it is quite obvious that the important information was in front of the district court. So you agree that it's in the record, right?
I agree it's in the record, Your Honor. In fact, it's because it's in the record that it becomes error.
Well, I'm going to have you explain that to me, because it seems to me the next step in Kostelnik wasn't just in deciding to reverse and remand, wasn't just that the district court failed to look at net income in a very complicated question of what is the obligor's ability to pay, but it was also that it was so disproportionate in that case, meaning the spousal maintenance was such a disproportionately large chunk of the take-home pay of the obligor in that case. So, and we don't have that here, do we?
Well, I think that the two-step process you're citing, Judge Bratfeld, makes perfect sense. And it's the one, and it's precisely what we expect of all appellants. Show me error, then show me prejudice. It wouldn't be sufficient if I came to the court and said, the finding isn't there, but it makes no difference. I need to show the court both that there is an error, which there is, there's no ability to make that finding. And in fact, we have the district court explicitly saying it's basing maintenance on a finding of gross income. When it finds Mr. Walker's income, it says for the purposes of child support and spousal maintenance, Mr. Walker's income is this gross figure. That's the error. Now I have to show you the...
So I need to ask you one question that I didn't see raised in the brief. You've described it accurately. I mean, in the sense that the district court's findings of fact only include a finding as to Mr. Walker's gross income. That's accurate. But, you know, the same is true of Mrs. Walker. The only calculation or statement of her ability to meet her own needs is based on her gross income. So in a sense, you know, as you said, the district court had all the information about net income for both Mr. Walker and Mrs. Walker, but that the findings that we see in our, you know, rather lengthy district court opinion only capture the gross income part. It doesn't necessarily mean that the district court didn't look at net income, right? I mean, we have lots of cases that say that, that this court, before reversing and remanding, should be sure that the district court didn't consider all of the evidence in front of it in light of these, again, very involved and intertwined spousal maintenance factors.
I can understand, Your Honor, the inclination to give the district court the benefit of the doubt. I don't think we can read the district court's findings to say something other than what they say. This isn't
You do agree that the district court only states wife's gross income, right? And compares the two that way?
I would agree. I would say, Your Honor, that is a slightly more complicated issue than Kostelnik. This court has reached different outcomes as to the net income for a maintenance recipient. That's an issue with where the law is somewhat less clear. But the law is crystal clear on net income for an obligor, and that we don't expect people to pay in pre-tax dollars because they simply don't have that money. We expect them to pay in post-tax dollars.
Well, I understand what you're saying in terms of, again, you're being accurate on the case law, but it would be odd, wouldn't it, for the district court to recite the gross income for the obligor and then look at net income for the obligee, wouldn't it? And on the other hand, say we granted you relief and we reversed and remanded for a new spousal maintenance determination, what are you suggesting then the district court should also consider Mrs. Walker's net income, because that would be fair. It'd be comparing apples to apples instead of apples to oranges. We're not comparing. It's a lot more complicated. I am totally oversimplifying, but you get my point, I think.
It might be fair. It wasn't raised in a notice of related appeal, so it's not assigned as error here. And my suggestion would be that the fact that the district court made more errors than were raised in appellant's brief doesn't necessarily...
of it. And again, looking at the spousal maintenance factors, some of the evidence is, you know, fits in some of the boxes, some overlaps and fits in other boxes. How do we know, you know, to your point, how do we see the prejudice in the actual determination of spousal maintenance?
Because, Judge Bratfeld, it left Mr. Walker $1,000 a month under what it found he needed and he needed to pay. And it left Ms. Walker $1,000 a little bit more actually over what she needed.
So what's your best chart in your brief? Is that in your reply brief to show that $1,000, I think you call it under or deficit?
I think that chart is probably the most helpful at illustrating where we see the basic error that happened here.
Okay. And so that's your reply brief at what, 4? Do I have the right thing? I think I do.
I believe you do, but let me confirm the page.
Okay. So here's what I was troubled by in that, and I'm probably missing something. You're both much more expert than I am at family law. But it seemed to me, and I was trying to follow your math, it is tricky, but it seemed to me that you were assuming that the child support, basic child support, didn't get spent. I'm confused by that.
It's not an assumption, Judge Bratfeld, that doesn't get spent. It's that the district court here made a consolidated finding about Ms. Walker's needs for herself and the children together.
Yeah, but the district court didn't purport to be in wife's approved budget, did not purport to be including basic needs of the children. I mean, there's no finding to that effect.
That was Ms. Walker's testimony, and it was the only budget she presented.
I think that's an overstatement of Ms. Walker's testimony. She does indicate that there are a couple of items that she augmented in light of her need to make purchases for the children for food, for clothing. I think travel was another one. And some of those the district court very specifically rejected, like travel. And said that was not going to go in Mrs. Walker's budget.
Respectfully, though, Judge Bratfold, Ms. Walker presented this evidence. These were her exhibits. Exhibit 25, my expenses for myself and four children. Ms. Walker's expert, these are her expenses for herself and four children. At every step of the process, Ms. Walker presented her expenses, not individually for herself and separately for the children, but as a whole, as a combined all-in. And it's that central error that really cascades into every other portion of the district court.
Did your client do the same thing?
He did not, Judge Bjork, and I believe Mr. Walker presented a budget that had children's expenses, but separately itemized in another column so that the court could see what his expenses were for himself and the expenses he intended to pay for the children, but he attempted to separate them out so the court could see the portion of expenses attributable to each. I'd also suggest that as a child support even if Mr. Walker had committed that error, as a child support obligor, he is in a different position. And as a maintenance payor, he's in a different position than someone who is receiving several different buckets of income, potentially to meet the same expenses. And I would say that I should spend my final 4 minutes before this court really emphasizing the error here, because the statute is clear that when the court orders maintenance and when it orders child support, those are separate buckets that have to be treated separately. We provide maintenance for the purpose of meeting the needs of a former spouse. We provide child support for meeting the needs of children. And this court in 3 non-precedential decisions has really made clear the errors that occur when we conflate those buckets. And one of those errors here is that in reaching Ms. Walker's budget, the court has undeniably baked in over $500 per month, $6,000 per year in expenses for children that will undoubtedly end. There is 19.
So what kinds of things are included?
You know, Your Honor, that it's a little bit difficult to say because the court doesn't explain how it got its math. But where you can find this is on, pardon me, on pages 8 and 9 of Mr. Walker's reply brief, there are a list of the children's expenses that were explicitly itemized in Ms. Walker's budget that total $1,975. The district court then backs out and awards as an upward deviation only $1,400. So as a matter of basic math, we know at least $500 just in children's expenses. That doesn't get to the increased items for hobbies, the increased items for clothing. So Mr. Walker is paying a permanent or indefinite maintenance award for expenses for teenage children that will all come to an end in the next several years. The other primary issue is that when you consolidate children's expenses, as occurred here, when you say this is an all-in bucket, you create a problem where Mr. Walker is double paying. To the extent that basic child support is intended to pay for the children's clothing, and then that same clothing budget is included in a maintenance recipient, in a maintenance budget, he's paying maintenance to meet that clothing budget. And then the basic child support calculation, again, has layered in the assumption that some portion that he needs to contribute to clothing. Same would be true of food. Same would be true of any number of other expenses, such that in Ponciano, this court made a point of saying there's a danger of the double count. If you don't separate out spousal expenses from children's expenses, we may be paying the same expenses twice.
But isn't the standard of living during the marriage part of it? Even when all is said and done, the husband's monthly expenses are higher than wife's, and she has primary custody of four children.
You know, Your Honor, she doesn't have primary custody. She has joint custody.
Joint custody, but they're with her most of the time. Yeah, thanks his expenses for that. I agree. Yep.
His expenses for himself and four children are slightly higher than hers, but because of expenses that he has, then she does not. And again, those were the district court's findings, not ours. The district court found that was his budget, and that's not appealed. And while the marital standard of living does play a role, Your Honor, when it plays a role in child support, it has to play a role in the form of an upward deviation, meaning it plays a role in looking at whether the guideline amount of child support is sufficient to meet expenses for these children under these circumstances. We could not know that unless the children's expenses are delineated separately from those of a spouse. Again, because we then see the error we have here, which is that Ms. Walker undeniably is getting $1,000 more than the court said, than the court found her to need, while Mr. Walker has $1,000 less. That's not from the result of any deliberate equitable finding by the court that, you know, based on how the budgets came down and how the incomes look, I find it's equitable that Mr. Walker run a shortfall and Ms. Walker run a surplus. I'm not saying the court could have made those findings, but it didn't. This isn't a deliberate decision by the district court. It's an error because we're compounding and layering expenses instead of acknowledging they've been actually met once through maintenance. Now we're meeting them again through basic child support. And without determining whether or not that basic support is sufficient, we're then awarding an upward deviation to meet many of the expenses that could already be met through other income sources. Now, that is precisely why we asked this court to designate the opinion here today precedential, because while Hermer, Ponciano, and Panuski have all been decided relatively recently, this error of commingling expenses for a maintenance recipient and minor children continues to reoccur. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Lees, proceed when you're ready and identify yourself for the record.
May it please the court and counsel. My name is Tim Lees. I'm Laura Walker's lawyer. Laura Walker's the respondent in this matter. We are repeatedly reminded by case law that every spousal maintenance case is unique. Therefore, there are few, if any, bright line rules that we can apply uniformly across all spousal maintenance cases. In Dobrin, our Supreme Court told us, we take this opportunity to remind counsel that each marital dissolution proceeding is unique and centers upon individualized facts and circumstances of the parties, and that accordingly, it is unwise to view any marital dissolution decision as enunciating an immutable rule of law applicable in any other proceedings. And I think I raise that because it feels like Mr. Boulat and his client are seeking some very strong bright line rules here that would cause many spousal maintenance awards to be reversed. But it's important in this case that we look to the entirety of the case. We can't lose sight of the forest for the trees, as is said. In other words, as we dive into these nuances of trying to mathematically find certainty as to either party's budget or precise calculations of income, let's always keep in mind the big picture, and that is this. We have a relatively long-term marriage of 18 years with Mr. Walker earning $308,000 a year. That's $25,000 gross a month. And Mrs. Walker, after having been out of the workforce for most of the marriage, earning $68,994 a year. Those are gross numbers.
Apologize for interrupting you. I do appreciate the overview of the party situations. And obviously, you know, we do have a long district court order here.
Correct.
That spends quite a bit of time explaining the different economic positions of the parties, as well as the marital standard of living. So we have all of that. You talked, though, earlier about bright lines. And so I guess I'd like you to start on one point that seems to be a bright line of agreement between the appellant and respondent, and that is that the district court did make one error, all right? The district court did double count the car allowance that Mr. Walker received and made a mistake, included it in its assessment of his ability to pay twice. And so we know that it's, you know, about $10,000 a year of error, right?
Correct.
Now, you argue that's de minimis, and you cite a bunch of cases. And then, of course, the not surprisingly, appellant disagrees with that, says that's not at all de minimis. I mean, help me out here. How is a court supposed to decide what's de minimis and what isn't? It can't be based on just a number, you know, that in
Certainly not.
Cases we see a $25 error, right? This is much more than a $25 error. So, you know, it therefore is not de minimis. That can't be the way we reason it, is it?
I don't argue that. What I submit
I know
is,
you don't, but I want some support for it. So that's what I'm looking for.
what I would address that, Your Honor, is if there's an error, the way we determine whether it's de minimis is, but for that error, would a different result have been reached? I can tell you, and really my esteemed colleague, Mr. Boulet, has not pointed to any error that's caused by that finding. With regard
to because Mr. Boulet has a bit of a parallelism in his case, though, because when it comes down to looking at, comparing the excess, the surplus versus that he alleges Ms. Walker has, you disagree, and his view of Mr. Walker's deficit or lack of money, guess what? It's the number 1,000. And if you take that $10,000 a year and look at it over the course of a monthly basis, it's about $900. So he does have a way of suggesting to this court that this is not de minimis.
Yes.
$900 a month.
But the way he's getting to this shortfall is incorrect. And I'll explain that. First of all, the reason it's de minimis with regard to the child support is because those guidelines, only the maximum income those guidelines ever take for a parent is $15,000 a month. So that's $180,000 salary. This extra $10,000 did not put him, it did not change. He earns well over $15,000 a month, with or without that extra $10,000. When we get to Mr. Walker's shortfall of $1,000, I would point out, while the findings weren't appealed, Mr. Walker's budget still includes over $1,000 of children's expenses that the judge said, no, I'm gonna have wife pay those and you pay the upward deviation that you agreed to, and she'll pay those. So now he doesn't have that $1,000 on his budget, and she's got that extra $1,000 plus on her budget. But I would like to point the court to page 11 of our brief when we're talking about the calculations. And when we talk about whether there was truly error here in not finding a net monthly income. And if we take the lowest net monthly income possible, the lowest for Mr. Walker, from all the pleadings, all the charts, that's $12,193 a month. And that is exclusive. That does not include his $63,000 bonus he gets every year. With those monthly, with that income, less his monthly living expenses, less the spousal maintenance awarded, he has a very nominal deficit of $76. And again, that excludes his bonus. So unless his $62,000 bonus was taxed at 99.88%, which we know it's not, we can take judicial notice of that.
Well, are you referring now to the spousal maintenance factors? Because the first spousal maintenance factor does indicate that we should consider financial resources of the spousal maintenance obligee, including any support that might be ordered. So that is a factor in spousal maintenance.
Which factor is the court's?
I'm referring to A under subdivision 2. So the financial resources of the party seeking maintenance, and I'm going to skip a couple of words because they don't matter. And then it says, including the extent to which a provision for support of a child living with the party includes a sum for that party as custodian. So it is something that we look at in spousal.
No, we don't have that in this case. We don't have a unique support, a unique child support award that says part of this is for the parent.
No, that's not what subdivision A says, I don't think.
I believe it does.
It says if there is to the extent to which a provision for support of a child living with a party includes a sum for that party as custodian. Mother gets this money as custodian for the children.
It includes a sum for that parent.
No, I disagree, counsel. I don't think that's what subdivision A says.
I believe that, I respectfully disagree. I feel very strongly that I'm correct on that. In other words, how the statutes are set up, and again, these are two separate statutes in two separate chapters. Before you can even get to establishing child support, you need to first determine the party's incomes. And that is through the spousal maintenance statute. And it's with that whole spousal maintenance analysis that we get into lifestyle.
Right, and I did follow with interest your analysis of this order of operations, and yes. I appreciate it because certainly that's what we tend to see, is that there is a rhythm to the way in which the district court lays out the order, and it's the way that we saw this district court do it. Maintenance is determined first, the numbers are put into the child support calculator, and then we get the results. I have not seen a case, and maybe you could point me to one, an opinion of this court or the Supreme Court that suggests that order of operations means that when looking at spousal maintenance,
it's a logical impossibility to say when we're establishing the spousal maintenance, we have to include the child support number in there. But we can't have a child support number until we create the spousal maintenance. How can we put the child support number in the first step in the spousal maintenance analysis?
I get your point, counsel. The problem is that all of these issues are intertwined. So even though you would suggest to me that we can't get a final order, you know, on child support without determining spousal maintenance, totally true. But at the end of the day, you know, the district court and this court needs to review the entire dissolution.
But Your Honor, support obligations have nothing to do with budgets and whether people can afford child support.
That's a good
point. In fact, to the contrary, And we've cited the law and justice. They told us ability to pay child support is inherent in the statute. The legislature has already determined for us, whether we like it or not, how much they think it costs to raise a child on any given household income level, and then attributes that cost between the parties based on the proportions of their incomes, right? And there's also the mechanism built into the statute that says, here's the calculations to determine whether a party has the ability to pay that child support. Okay. And the calculator, in fact, makes that calculation. And in this case, the law provided by our legislature said he has the ability to pay. Now, where that sounds inconsistent, Your Honor, is again, the difference between the two analyses.
But Mr. Lee, doesn't the fact that child support is a decision to be made after maintenance is decided, that the statute governs what the amount of the need is, if you will,
correct,
rather than the facts of the specific case. I mean, doesn't that, you know, that the result of that errors flow forward into child support as well?
Well, again, that $10,000 error had no effect on the child support calculation. And
what about spousal maintenance? You've not
answered
that.
No, I haven't gotten to that yet. You know, first of all, why didn't the court make that finding? It certainly would have been helpful, but Mr. Walker himself was all over the board on that issue. And this is all from the evidence. In his pre-hearing statement, he said that his net income exclusive of a bonus was $15,298. His testimony at trial was that his net monthly income exclusive of his bonus was $14,000. In his brief at page 7, he says his net monthly income without bonus was $12,193. So he's all over the place. I think, again, my calculation, how the judge looked at this correctly, And again, we're not, what the court has to do is consider all the 552 factors. It doesn't necessarily, and there, it doesn't necessarily have to make under the statute a specific finding. It has to consider all of those factors. And the court did that. And so I think when the court said, look, there's no reasonable argument here that he can't pay this, meaning even if you use these lowest income numbers, he can pay it. But I've got to make one quick point. When you ask, when we just add up all the obligations and say he can't afford it, it's because certain expenses under a maintenance analysis are absolutely fine for maintenance. Let's say a party spends $500 a month to belong to a country club all through the marriage. In the spousal maintenance analysis, yeah, that is a very appropriate cost. And that's appropriate expense for his budget, okay? And in determining the amount of maintenance. Now, when we get over the child support side, do we really think a litigant can go to court and say, judge, I can't afford that child support because I'm paying for my country club. Something is does not mean it can afford child all these obligations. And again, I know Judge Bretfold, we disagree on that language, but I really do think that's pointing to something different, such as cases where a parent has a disabled child and stays home, and that child support obligation segregates a part of that money to support so that parent can stay home. And that is a support issue for the child and not a maintenance issue. So I would plead with the court to, well, I'm not going to tell the court to do anything. That's not my place. But I ask the court to consider my analysis in that respect. My time is up. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Mr. Boulet, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to pick up on a point that Judge Bjorkman raised in questioning, which is that these are big, long-term and interconnected obligations, which is why it's important that the court get them right. We're not here today saying that Ms. Walker, in her circumstances, gets no spousal maintenance or no child support. We're here saying that because these are long-term obligations that are continuing in nature and that will be modified, one of the party's daughters is already emancipated. The other three will emancipate over the next several years. It's really important that the court get it right. Based on the way Ms. Walker presented the evidence, the district court found she needed $8,700 a month for herself and four children. As it presently stands, she is set to get $8,700 a month indefinitely, even after she no longer has four children at home. And even though this court's published decision in Muskelowitz says, we do not award spousal maintenance for adult children. It's not that Ms. Walker deserves no support. It's that we have to be certain we delineate support in the proper bucket so that when the court returns to modify, so that when the court has to entertain a motion like the one that's presently being held in abeyance because Mr. Walker lost his job and experienced a really significant six-figure pay cut, that we're able to appropriately delineate what bucket these things belong in. So when we take $500 in explicitly children's expenses and we put them in the maintenance bucket, when we take an unknown amount of additional money for clothing, for hobbies, for travel, for other things, and put them in the maintenance bucket, we make it extraordinarily hard for the court to adjust maintenance, to terminate child support, to make the decisions it has to make. I'm sympathetic to counsel's order of operations argument because the circularity of the maintenance and support statutes isn't lost on anyone who practices family law. There is a certain extent to which we continue to have to check and recheck these numbers as the court hones in on the right one. But that circularity hasn't stopped the court in three prior cases recently from insisting that district courts delineate between what is for children and what is for a spouse so that when these maintenance modifications arise, the court can clearly figure out what bucket needs to be modified. Now, counsel spent a lot of time emphasizing that ability to pay is baked into the child support statute. And for that reason, it need not concern the district court or this court. If all the court had done is award guideline child support, counsel's arguments might be correct. but the court didn't award guideline child support. The court deviated from the child support guidelines. And so you are no longer operating under a presumptively correct award under 518A. You're operating under 518A43, which requires the court to find that the children need more than what basic support would otherwise provide for them, and that there's an ability to pay. And that ability to pay, again, has to consider all of Mr. Walker's obligations. It can't just consider a cherry-picked few, because the reality is he does have to meet these obligations with the cash available to him. Cash he currently doesn't have, according to all the parties' experts. I would spend my last 2 minutes focusing in on 518.14, because I do think the award of attorney's fees here has to be mentioned as well. Ms. Walker left this marriage with $1.1 million in assets. Yet before the district court even knew what her attorney's fees were, it found her to be in need of fees, and it found Mr. Walker to have the ability to pay them. It was only after trial that Ms. Walker actually submitted her fees and was then awarded $40,000, despite having, again, $1 million in assets. Now, there is no support in this court's published case law for an award of attorney's fees where a party is already a millionaire. Understandably, counsel wants to direct this court to a comparative analysis. Well, but Mr. Walker had an inheritance that Ms. Walker didn't have.
Well, to the extent she's a millionaire, it's not liquid assets. So you'd agree with that.
I would agree with that. But liquidity, Your Honor, hasn't troubled this court in either of the published cases that we cite. And in fact, in the Israni case decided issued just Monday, Ms. Israni made the argument, my assets are in real estate, not in cash. Therefore, I need maintenance. And the court again said no. The character of your assets isn't dispositive here. I'd also point out that Mr. Walker is in much the same situation. I don't know that the record demonstrates he has any more liquidity than she does. So if liquidity matters, it really truly has to matter for both sides. It can't matter for just one. The statutory focus of 518.14 is need. It's not comparative as it was prior to 1991. And because where a party is a millionaire, we can't find that need. And we don't look to whether their spouse may have more because of an inheritance to determine whether or not they do. Your Honor, if I to sum up, taken together, the district court made a number of errors here that led it, despite the correct order of operations, to conflate expenses, to overstate Mr. Walker's financial circumstances, and to fundamentally leave the parties in a different and in unequal position that wasn't the express intention of the district court. For that reason, we ask this court to reverse for a recalculation of the appropriate awards. Thank you.
All right, thank you both for your arguments and your briefs in this matter. The case is submitted and we will issue our opinion within the statutory time period. And that concludes the oral portion of our calendar for today. So thank you all.